This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's an awful lot of money involved in higher education, and that's not even going into the cost of attending college for a student. More and more, universities and colleges are becoming some of the leading economic drivers of their communities.
As state governments are looking at their budgets, I think an important argument for college and universities to make is that they are critical drivers of state economies.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll find out the financial impact of college. We'll also hear about the latest apps for the classroom and spend an academic minute with the question, what's the deal with hot lava? I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. College and economics have been discussed in the same stories for quite some time. The usual discussion involves the high cost of a student attending school. But there is another angle to this discussion, the economic benefits of having a school in your town. Jason Lane looks at this topic in depth in his new book, Universities and Colleges as Economic Drivers, Measuring Higher Education's Role in Economic Development. Jason is Director of Education Studies and Senior Fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government and Associate Professor of Education Administration and Policy Studies at the University at Albany. We spoke about the new book recently, and I asked if churning out qualified students is no longer good enough for schools.
Well, I mean, it absolutely is. It's just that college universities have always done so much more than that, and as state governments are looking at their budgets, I think an important argument for college and universities to make is that they are critical drivers of state economies.
You do go into this book into international competition. Now, how does the local college have anything to do with that?
Well, I think the local college has a lot to do with the fact that there is an international marketplace where countries are really thinking about their economic competitiveness, but for each nation to be competitive, and for that matter, for each state to be competitive in the U.S., we really got to think about the state level, if not even the town or city level, that the local college really is a critical impact in that in terms of producing a workforce that is employable, that's going to drive innovation, that's going to be able to use innovation. But even the local colleges are attracting international students from outside of the country to these towns, and they help raise visibility as well. But you know, they also are employers in the local region, and they can help attract businesses from outside of the area into the local economy.
Are there some places? We've always heard the expression that's a college town. How important are college towns, and how important are the colleges to those towns?
Well, I think college towns are absolutely important for each and every state that they're in. For the college town itself, for the really traditional college town, the university is probably the most critical anchor that they have. And in many cases, it's the only employer in that town. It's the thing that keeps that town thriving long term, because they are the ones that are employing people, or they are the ones that are providing the students who have discretionary money who can spend in the local businesses, who are there to serve students or to serve staff and faculty. So I think colleges are critical to college towns. College towns are often places where we see major research going on, and that research is what is driving the statewide economy and the innovation that's happening throughout the state. So they are both important for the local community, but they're important for the states as well.
It almost sounds like there's a kind of a butterfly effect here, that it starts from the college itself and just goes, well, as you said, it goes globally.
It really does. What I think is important here is that each type of college university has a different impact. So a major research university is going to be able to produce new innovation, produce spillovers that can then be economically commercialized and sold in the marketplace, in addition to the more traditional functions of educating students and educating a workforce for the 21st century. But even our community colleges play a critical role in helping existing businesses be more successful in terms of training the workers for their industries and thinking about new technologies that they need to adapt. So I think all the way from our community colleges through our major research universities, colleges and universities are absolutely critical drivers of our economies.
Is this a message that has to really get through to policymakers to avoid, you know, cuts that might just, you know, be counterproductive?
It is. It's unfortunate that I think many of our politicians and policymakers think and realize that college universities are incredibly increasingly a critical driver for economic development, and we hear calls from the White House about increasing our completions in terms of producing more associate degree holders and baccalaureate degree holders. But it doesn't seem to resonate all the time when we see economic downturns, because it's often an easy budget to strike at, because we can shift the cost on to parents and students. At least we have been able to. But now we're really hitting a critical precipice right now, because we can't increase costs that much more, because there's a lot of concern about it, and rightly so. And ultimately, it's going to end up affecting the ability of colleges and universities to contribute back to their economies. And the reality is that most times when states are in an economic downturn, it's up to the college and university to really help pull the state out. And if you cut the budgets to those college and universities, they can't do it as effectively as they could otherwise.
But one story we never hear is the cost of college actually going down. Does that have to happen eventually?
Yeah, I don't think it has to happen eventually, but I do think it is happening. Slowly, we've recently seen reports out about some of the private colleges in particular decreasing at least their price point. And part of that's reflecting the fact that a lot of the rhetoric around the cost of education is based upon, in some ways, exaggerated price points that most students don't actually pay, because they end up discounting the rate significantly through financial aid. But I do think we need to have a real conversation about what the cost of education should be and what is the return on investment that states get and that students get out of both our public and private higher education institutions.
Let's go global again. Internationally, are colleges and universities overseas, are they doing a better job churning out more competitive students?
I think we certainly see more competition in terms of there being a greater supply of students. I think the U.S. still is the global leader in producing students and citizens and employees and leaders who are critical thinkers, who can learn as they grow, and can really think about innovation and be entrepreneurial. So I think the U.S. still has a real leadership role to play and will continue to play in those areas. But we do see a lot more competition for students, and where, you know, we've seen the market share for international students for the U.S. slide over the last decade. We get a smaller market share than what we did 10 years ago. And a lot of countries have seen that the way in which the U.S. and the U.K. and other Western countries has become successful is by investing in higher ed. And so they're emulating that, and they're investing in their college and university. So while, you know, they may not be doing a better job right now, there's certainly competition on the horizon that I think is going to be critical for us to address, and it makes it important for the U.S. to continue to invest in higher ed so we continue to can be the leader.
Well, the book is called Universities and Colleges as Economic Drivers. What is going to happen in the next 5-10 years? Will they keep driving the economy forward?
They absolutely are, and it may be in a variety of ways. I think states are going to increasingly turn to college and universities to really serve as the anchor tenants of the state. As companies leave, as manufacturers leave, college and universities remain. A lot of the small towns in rural and more desolate areas of states are surviving solely because of their college and universities. And in a place like New York, where we've had a lot of issues in terms of retaining both our population and in our corporations, we've reached a turning point now. And I think a great example is a program called Startup New York, where the governor is designating state tax-free zones around each of the college campuses in upstate New York. And the whole idea is try to partner with college and universities in a meaningful way to recruit new companies back to upstate New York so that we can have more jobs, so that we can hopefully add more population to the upstate economy. I think we are going to see long-term states thinking more critically about what colleges and universities can provide and really trying to work with them in meaningful ways through university, industry, government partnerships. We often do think of college and universities in terms of educating the workforce, and we hope more than that, educating citizens. But the reality is that these institutions not just educate students, but they are producing new innovations that drive the economy. They help build new corporations through this new knowledge. They also help support existing companies in terms of what they're doing. But they are a critical employer. They are attracting faculty and staff and students from other regions to come and live in those communities. And they're investing in new buildings and new infrastructure, which ultimately can help revitalize impoverished areas of towns and communities where they're in. So I think part of it is the message of this book is really to think about the holistic ways in which college and universities help drive the local economies.
It is interesting you say that, because I've seen so many areas where the university or the college is really the only place where there is money coming in and new construction being done.
That's right. I mean, it's and I think college and universities are being a little bit more thoughtful in terms of where they're investing those monies as well, because they see an important relationship between the city and the university. We can think the traditional town-gown relationship, but you know, there is a codependency here. The more successful the town is, the more successful the university, the more successful the university, the more successful the town. And so I think we do see universities thinking more critically about the way they can be good partners and good neighbors and good citizens. And you know, part of that's investing in communities. Part of it's also these developing pilot programs, because a lot of the property universities own is tax-exempt. And so a lot of universities now are beginning to provide payments in lieu of taxes as a way to help pay for the community services, fire, police, and so forth, that they benefit from, but really haven't paid for necessarily for a long period of time.
I've seen some colleges that have a public-private partnership. Is that becoming more common?
It absolutely is. I mean, part of the advantage of what universities have, whether they are public or private, is this ability to work with private partners. I mean, so we see a whole slew of things. Hotels being developed on campuses, outsourcing to a variety of partners, whether that's for food or for maintenance or even for healthcare. But we also see things in terms of working with corporations to develop new research that we're working hand-in-hand now. An example is the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering here at the University of Albany that really is working with corporate partners like IBM and GE to really think about what is the next generation of nanotechnology, and that we can provide space to bring them together to work collaboratively and also provide our academic researchers with the resources they need to be on the cutting edge. And that's, you know, that's the extreme of it. But there's also things like senior living centers that are being developing and downtown playhouses, and all of these are public-private partnerships as a way to help to revitalize local communities as well.
Jason Lane is Director of Education Studies and Senior Fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government and Associate Professor of Education Administration and Policy Studies at the University at Albany. His new book is called Universities and Colleges as Economic Drivers, Measuring Higher Education's Role in Economic Development. It's published by SUNY Press. Still to come, got a new school year? There's an app for that. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1199. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Technology is finding a place in a lot of classrooms, and the people who make the technology are more than happy to supply teachers and students with new apps that try to get today's lessons learned. Here to talk about some of the newest apps for the classroom is Galileo Vieira, a senior product marketing manager for the Windows Store. We spoke recently, and I asked if teachers are really substituting apps for books.
I mean, I guess it is, right? The app tendency is very big. We see it all over in smartphones and tablets, and now even, you know, traditional PCs with Windows 8. So it's a big movement. That said, obviously it doesn't substitute a good teacher education and good parenting as well.
Well, how are teachers using these?
I think in all sorts of manners. I mean, you have, you know, a variety of apps. It's just infinite in choice. And so you can have teachers using them as supplemental content for students. So when they get home, hey, check out this app, you know, brush up on some subjects. There's a really good app called Khan Academy that's very well known, that has over 4,500 video lessons that are very engaging for students. that covers all subject matters. So that can be a good complement to what they've learned in classroom, for example.
Well, how early a student do you have to be? I mean, is this going, you know, as early as kindergarten?
Well, I'll cite you my example. I have a 3-year-old and an 8-year-old, but my 3-year-old has been, you know, using a tablet, a Windows 8 tablet, for a year now. Obviously, he loves the little games, you know, your Angry Birds, your Disney games that we have. But we are mindful, and we do have some great apps we install, which are we call edutainment apps, right? They're games that hide the educational factors behind it. So a very common one, very popular one, is called Zoo Train, which is a bunch of mini games that actually teach toddlers how to recognize letters, recognize words, recognize numbers, but all in a game environment where they get stars and they get points and they get accomplishments and so on. So it starts that early.
And as students get older, how more complex do the apps get?
You know, again, it's a wide variety. For example, you get into high school, there's some really cool apps. There's one called Algebra Touch, which is an algebra app, as the name implies. Teaches you how to understand formulas and equations, but it's an app, it's a touch app, so you can interact with the equation and drag around components of it so you can understand how that would change the solution of the equation. There's a periodic table app that's similar in nature, where it's got great visualization, you know, for the video game people who love video games, very rich graphics, and you can engage with it, interact with it, learn more about the elements. A personal favorite of mine is Flashcards Pro. As the name implies, it's a flashcard app, but it uses what we call speech-to-text technology, so the computer actually talks to you, reads what's on that card so you can interact with it. And then obviously you get into college, you get into using more of the Office, you know, productivity suite to write down all your college notes, work on your term papers and presentations. And today for our Windows customers, we have a great app and a service called SkyDrive, which is great for college and high school students. It literally lets you store any of your files, any of your documents, term papers, research in the cloud, on the internet. You can access it from any device you own, and you can work with your friends in real time. So if you're working on a term paper for college, you can have somebody in the library, somebody in a dorm room, somebody somewhere else, all working at the same time on the same document, seeing each other's progress as you go along.
Are some of these apps automated to the point where they can give you new quizzes daily, say like the algebra app? Could it give you different examples and different problems every day?
That's actually a great question, and it is a model that's being used by lots of app builders, as we call them, developers, right? Where you download an app, it has a whole variety of free content, but if you did want extra content, you can either, you know, buy some or, you know, subscribe to more content. And get those on a daily or weekly or monthly basis, however the app builder determines. But yes, that's definitely a possibility.
Are schools embracing this? And if so, are they doing it happily?
So I can speak from my experience, again, based on my 8-year-old who goes to public school here out in Washington. They totally embrace it. They know it's a reality. Obviously, they like to recommend, you know, limiting screen time, as we call it. And so nothing, like I say, nothing substitutes good parenting. So there's a good equilibrium you can maintain between, hey, what the child learns in school, and they have interactive whiteboards and, you know, they work on the computer in school and all that good stuff, what they do at home, how much time they spend on their device at home. And obviously, you know, there's nothing substitute go to good old pencil and paper right now. My daughter's a good example. She's learned how to paint and draw on her tablet, but I give her some, you know, colored pencils and paper, and she does just as well on that. So, you know, you got to keep that complementary aspect to using all this technology.
This is all well and good if you can afford a tablet or an iPhone. Is there something that can be done for students who maybe don't have the means to get all these?
Totally. So obviously Microsoft has a whole bunch of donation programs that happen, but there's actually currently a campaign we have, and you can go to windows.com to learn about it, where a student who can't afford a computer can actually send an email out to parents and friends and family asking for them to chip in. It's called a chip-in program, where they pick a tablet or a Windows computer and they tell their friends, hey, this is the one I want, and everybody can put in $5, $10, something like that. Microsoft will actually match some of that funding so that student can get that PC that they so desire.
What's your favorite app that you've seen lately that you just went, really? That is so cool. I wish I had that.
I'll have to go back to the Khan Academy app. It's mind-blowing how much you can learn And, you know, I've been out of school for a few years, and I've been recently brushing up on the French Revolution. And it's just a great way to learn about it. It's great videos, very engaging, very entertaining, actually, to watch the professors teach through those videos.
Galileo Vieira is a senior product marketing manager for the Windows Store. On a totally different subject, not all hot lava is created equal. Or is that equally? No matter, it's still the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Few things in nature are as dramatic and unstoppable as a lava flow. Einat Lev, postdoctoral research fellow at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory, explains efforts to better understand how flowing lava interacts with its surrounding environment.
Volcanic lava comes in many styles and flavors. Different kinds of flows cover the ocean floors, build giant mountains, and form parts of continents. The remains are common on the Moon, Venus, and Mars. Studying the dynamics of flows helps us devise defenses for communities near volcanoes. Hardened lavas also provide a lasting record of the frequency of eruptions and the chemical and physical mechanisms that drive them. I am part of a project aimed at improving an understanding of lava flows. In short, we make our own flows. We do this at a lab run by my colleagues at Syracuse University. Here we melt basaltic rocks, that is, hardened chunks of lava, by heating them back up to almost 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit in a furnace. We then pour the lava out onto surfaces made of different materials and shapes. So far, we've poured lava on wet and dry sand, soil, into metal flumes of various shapes, on ice and on snow, and into a bathtub full of water. We collect data on the lava's behavior using instruments such as infrared video cameras and high-temperature thermometers. The experiments have already yielded interesting results, including benchmarks we can use to predict the behavior of flows in natural conditions. For instance, in our experiments using ice and snow, our lavas have created shapes similar to those we see in Iceland, the U.S. Northwest, and other volcanic regions where there are glaciers. Flows that we poured into channels containing obstacles have taught us how lava may interact with buildings, trees, and cliffs. We have many plans for future experiments. We plan to recreate Martian flows by pouring lava onto the kind of dust-like material that covers that planet. We want to look at how water vapor, oxygen, and other gases are transmitted between ground and lava. Our new ability to create carefully controlled lava flows opens the door to new directions in the study of the Earth and beyond.
That was Einat Lev of Columbia University.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.